What is the worst thing that happened to Jesus? The list of injustices, of course, is rather long and distinguished, isn't it? But what was the worst thing that happened to Jesus? Was it the scourging he endured, the Roman cat of nine tails ripping flesh from bone? What about the cruel, scornful crown that was placed on his head, the crown of thorns with nails digging into his skull? Perhaps it was the punches, the slaps he received by the servants of the Sanhedrin, or later from the hands of the Roman soldiers. Or maybe it was for a moment when he staggered under the weight of the cross beam, laying on his tenderized, bloody back. Was it the agony of being impaled with 9-inch nails? Or was it the desperation of dehydration as his human body longed for just one drop of water? Or was it the pain of pushing himself up on those nails just to gain one breath of air? What was the worst thing that happened to Jesus? Maybe it was the emotional anguish that he experienced. After all, he was betrayed by some of his closest friends. He endured great humiliation, public degradation on the cross. Imagine people laughing at you, jeering at you as you die. I can't think of a worse way to die. But friends, these things weren't the worst thing that Jesus got. It wasn't the physical pain, not even the emotional anguish. Recall with me the Garden of Gethsemane as Jesus tells Peter, James, and John, "I am deeply grieved to the point of death." So he's preparing himself to walk towards the cross. What exactly was happening to Jesus when he said those very words? I mean, this is even more intense when you consider that this is God's own son. This is Jesus. He taught with authority. He healed the sick. He performed miracles. He calmed the storm. He miraculously fed the thousands. He always had a solution. He always had a comeback for the Pharisees. But in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was sweating blood. Why? What was it that as Jesus hung over the edge on the precipice of his passion, what troubled his soul? It wasn't the crown. It wasn't the nails. It wasn't the whips. It wasn't the mocking. It wasn't the scorn. It was something else. Let's read our passage now. Mark chapter 15. Starting in verse 21. They led him out to crucify him. They forced a man coming in from the country who was passing by to carry Jesus' cross. He was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. They tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. Then they crucified him and divided his clothes, casting lots for them to decide what each would get. Now it was 9 a.m. when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge written against him was, "The King of the Jews." They crucified 2 criminals with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by were yelling insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "Ha! The one who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself by coming down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests with the scribes were mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others, but he cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross so that we may see and believe." Even those who were crucified with him taunted him. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And at 3, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "See, he's calling for Elijah." Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, fixed it on a stick, offered him a drink, and said, "Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down." Jesus let out a loud cry and breathed his last. Then the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. When the centurion who was standing opposite him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." There were also women watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women followed him and took care of him. Many other women had come up with him to Jerusalem. This is God's holy and inspired word. Thanks be to God. So what happens at the cross? Here's the main point of the passage and the sermon this morning. On the cross, the Son of God was abandoned by God to bring sinners to God. What happened at the cross? Well, here it is. On the cross, the Son of God was abandoned by God to bring sinners to God. I want to give you 3 points from our passage this morning. Here's the first point. The world abandons Jesus. The world abandons Jesus. One by one, everyone abandons Jesus. It starts with the priests and the scribes in chapter 14 as they plot to kill Jesus. Judas then betrays Jesus. His three closest friends, they sleep on Jesus. Peter denies Jesus. This thread of abandonment continues in our story. Jesus was physically limited, of course, after receiving 39 lashes. So you have to imagine his back was mush. He was in a state of weakness, desperation. And so Simon of Cyrene, it says, carries his cross. Now, friends, can you think of another Simon who was supposed to carry a cross? In chapter 8, Jesus told Simon Peter, "Take up your cross and follow me." But here we have another Simon carrying the cross. Where is Peter? Where is Simon Peter? He's not here. He's gone, in fact. Friends, what is the most distinguishing, what is the most distinguishing mark of discipleship? It's taking one's cross and following Jesus. Simon of Cyrene is the first person to literally fulfill this. For Mark, discipleship isn't a sentimental gesture. It means to truly follow Jesus through thick and thin, and no matter what kind of discipleship, and no matter what kind of following of Jesus, a long obedience in the same direction. Simon of Cyrene is carrying a cross. Simon Peter is not around. One by one, they had all abandoned him. The soldiers took him to Golgotha along the Via Dolorosa. It's Latin for the way of sorrow or the way of suffering. This processional route through the old city in Jerusalem, a winding path intended to draw crowds for the purpose of shaming the criminal. And so Jesus was forced to walk by those who had perhaps waved palm branches just a few days earlier, those who had witnessed his miracles and his powerful teaching, those who had perhaps condemned him before Pontius Pilate. And notice the way verse 24 begins. It simply says, "Then they crucified him." What did crucifixion mean in the first century Roman world? Well, it was a Roman torture device. It was intended to maximize physical pain and social shame. No Roman citizen could be killed by a cross. It was reserved for criminals. It was reserved for the worst of the worst, in fact. And so large nails would be inserted, not through the hands, but between the two bones of the forearm near the wrists and also in the feet. Criminal would push up on the nails in order to kind of gasp for air before collapsing back into place. Death would come due to asphyxiation or shock, leading to cardiac and respiratory arrest. And so death would come slowly. It would often take days. Those who died on crosses were forever scandalized. Cultured Romans, cultured Gentiles refrained from even mentioning the word cross. It was kind of like a swear word in the first century. It was the lowest form of degradation. So much so that Paul, the apostle, would later write that the cross is utter foolishness. It's folly. You know, we hang crosses around our necks today, don't we? In the 21st century, they become kind of this religious object or just kind of a cool accessory. So we put crosses around our necks or earrings or whatever all the time. But friends, in the first century, it'd be kind of like wearing an electric chair necklace or how about lethal injection earrings? Why would we do that? These are shameful things, aren't they? Notice the criminals who were with him in verse 27. And he crucified two criminals with him, one on his right and one on his left. Does that sound familiar? Back in chapter 10, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, the sons of thunder, they asked Jesus, "Can we be with you in your glory?" One on the left and one on the right. Remember Jesus' answers to their question. He says, "You will be baptized with suffering like me." And that was a prophecy about their eventual suffering, their eventual death. But now at the cross, as Jesus is hanging there, where are they? They're not around, are they? In a strange sort of way, the two criminals occupy the place requested by James and John. Mark is subtly showing that the more suffering Jesus endures, the less likely his own will be standing with him. He is utterly alone in his suffering. In fact, we can trace out kind of concentric circles of rejection. We can begin at the edges of the scene and kind of move closer towards the cross. In the outer circle, I want you to notice verses 29 and 30. There's these people, these kind of bystanders, and they're passing by on the road, and they stand at a distance, and they mock Jesus. They say, "You would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days? That's what you said. Save yourself." So we move one circle in. In the second circle, we've got the religious leaders who say essentially, "Hey, he saved others. Can he save himself? Let the Messiah come down so that we may see and believe." If Twitter had been around in the first century, they would have spread the "save yourself" hashtag. And then there's the third circle. As you draw very close to the cross, we have these two criminals. Notice the end of verse 32. They are joining in the scorning. All of them are full of mocking. I want you to notice the word "insult" in verse 29. Those who passed by were yelling insults at them. And then verse 31, "in the same way they chief priests." And so the word there is literally blasphemo. Blasphemo. You can hear the word blaspheme from them, right? Blasphemo. This is the fourth use, the word blasphemo, in Mark's gospel. The first three times it was used against Jesus. The last use was in chapter 14 where Jesus was accused of blasphemy. But here, I want you to notice this. Now they are blaspheming him, which is only possible if he is God. They're saying more than they know. No doubt Jesus could come down. He had that sort of power. As they suggest, he had angel armies that he had on speed dial. He could snap his fingers and it would all be over. But that's not why he came. Throughout Mark's gospel, we've heard it from Jesus, haven't we? "I have come to die. I have come to suffer." And no one gets it. We see all of this kingly language and imagery in our passage. We see again something that Pastor Drew mentioned last week, this upside-down coronation of Jesus. The mockers say, "Hey, messiahs don't die. They rule, they conquer. So come down from the cross and we will see, we will believe in you." They will believe only if they see Jesus conquer through force. Mark puts forth a different sight that should evoke faith, right? The Messiah King on a cross. Of course, the irony is thick. He cannot save others and save himself. He can only save others by not saving himself. You know, the taunt of these three parties assumes that salvation of self is the greatest good. Jesus, however, hasn't taken a mission of self-help or self-fulfillment. He has come to be a ransom for others. And I just want you to notice this. He does this willingly. Friends, this was all planned. Now, we've looked at the details and kind of the foreground of these initial verses, but there's something that's kind of lurking in the background, and that's prophecy. I want you to see this. Wine mixed with myrrh, casting lots for his clothing, two criminals, one on either side, all of these mockers. This is all prophecy that's coming from Psalm 22, Psalm 69, Isaiah 53, written hundreds of years before this event. What does this tell us? It tells us this was all planned. God wasn't surprised by this wicked turn of events. This isn't Jesus getting what he deserved because of his poor choices or his punchy teaching. This isn't just the plots of evil men. It may seem like Jesus is totally out of control. But in reality, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit have planned all of this. And Jesus is now executing the plan. No one can take his life from him. In fact, normally it would take days, as I mentioned before, not 3 hours to die. The criminal on the cross would lose strength and fall unconscious. But Jesus was conscious to his very last breath. What does that tell us? Jesus gave his life. It was not taken. All of this was planned, friends. And I find this so instructive for us today. I want you to listen closely. Brothers and sisters, if the worst thing in human history, the greatest injustice, was planned by God and brought forth exceeding good to this world, how much should we trust God with our lesser evils and injustices? If God can plan the greatest good out of the greatest evil this world has ever seen, should we not trust him to do the same in our lives? Every time you face something painful or stressful or even unfathomable, a set of circumstances that press you and push you and strain your ability to walk with God rightly, and you kind of wonder, we kind of wonder, why is this happening? Every time your mind runs down that very familiar track, I want you to remember Jesus on the cross. Remember what he planned, what he did willingly, and how it brought forth exceeding good. And then I want you to trust him. I want you to trust him. He is utterly trustworthy. Let's move to the second point. There would be one more who would abandon Jesus. Let's look at verses 33 and 34. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, and at 3, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, my God, why have you abandoned me?" The scene changes dramatically as unnatural darkness descends on the land between 12 and 3 p.m. This should be the brightest time of the day, but darkness has descended. Darkness is an Old Testament sign of judgment. It signifies the curse of God. At the Exodus, a plague of darkness spread over the land just before the first Passover lamb was slain. Now, before the death of the ultimate Passover lamb, there is darkness again. And in this unnatural darkness, it's 3 p.m., Jesus cries out those piercing words, my God, why have you forsaken me? That line that Jesus utters comes from Psalm 22. Our brother Scott read this psalm earlier in our service. And we just have to ask the question, why did Jesus intentionally choose that line? I mean, he could have said a whole lot of things here on the cross, but he intentionally grabs at Psalm 22, and he chooses that first line to say on the cross, kind of the apex of redemptive history. Here we are, we're on the cross. And he chooses the first line in Psalm 22. Why? Well, Psalm 22 is a messianic psalm of David. It ends on a triumphant note. It ends with hope and confidence and praise and vindication and the proclamation of God's dominion to the ends of the earth. So Jesus, even as he's crying out this exclamation of agony, he knew God would eventually intervene and vindicate him on the earth. Death would not be the end of Jesus' story. He knew that. But don't let the end of Psalm 22 take away from the real anguish Jesus feels in this moment. Jesus quotes not the end of Psalm 22. He quotes the beginning. This cry represents the deepest possible pain. This is the moment when the Father places the sin of the world upon his Son as the Lamb of God. Jesus is completely identifying himself with sinners. Paul said it this way in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. He made him sin who knew no sin. Friends, there is a moment here of utter separation from God. Words seem to kind of fall short here for this preacher. Jesus was cast off. He was abandoned. He was deserted. He was left alone. He was spurned. He was marooned. He was cut off. And not just by the onlookers or the religious leaders or his best friends, but by God himself. We must remember, friends, that the Father and the Son have enjoyed perfect, unbroken harmony and fellowship within the Trinity for all eternity until now. And we can say that this rift is far worse than any mocking or scourging or physical trial of the cross. This is the searing pain of being separated from his Father and the damnation of God upon his shoulders. On that dark midday of Golgotha, when the sun stopped shining, the unthinkable happened. The bright, loving, approving face of the Father withdrew into a dark, frowning, punishing face of wrath. At 3 p.m., the Father turned his face away from Jesus for the first time and the last time. And the ancient eternal fellowship between the Father and Son was broken as divine wrath rained down on Jesus like a million Sodom and Gomorrahs. Friends, this was the cup of God's wrath. And Jesus drank it down. Now, this may feel a little disconnected from our experience. Would God really do this to Jesus? Well, let's think about this a little bit. Do you remember a time when your mom or your dad was really mad at you? Okay, so children, listen up. I'm trying to help you understand this a little bit better, too. They're mad at you because you had done something wrong, something stupid, something unwise. And do you remember their feeling of disappointment and anger towards you? It's a hard thing to experience this, but that anger, that sort of disappointment, that was a just anger. I want you to think about this. What if your parents knew all of the bad things you've ever done, even the stuff you got away with? That'd be awful. It'd be awful to kind of witness their faces. They're looking on you as they're kind of absorbing all the bad things, all the bad thoughts, like all of it. If they knew that and they looked at you, I mean, just imagine that kind of look, that kind of feeling that you would experience as well. Friends, our God is far, far, far more holy than the best of parents. And God hates sin. He knows our sin better than we even do. Yes, sure, sometimes we hate sin. Sometimes. We hate the big, gratuitous, culturally acceptable ones to hate, perhaps. But God hates all sin. Big evil injustices, but also the little attitudes and hidden prideful moments. Big kind of bold and brazen lies, but also little white lies we excuse away. Horrific evils like abortion or sex trafficking, but also private lustful thoughts. Can you imagine if the holy God of the universe were to unleash the full force of his furious anger on you and me for all of our sins all at once? We would be crushed, wouldn't we? This is what Christ endured on the cross. Wave after wave after wave of not just one person's sins, but the world's sins. Sins from every nation. Sins from every generation. all poured over Christ's sinless soul. Again and again, during those 3 hours, his soul recoiled as all the lies of civilization, the murders of 1,000 killing fields, the whorings of the world's armies, the compounding hatred and jealousy and pride of centuries were all poured on his blazing white, pure soul. Every bitter thought, every evil deed, crowning his blood-stained brow. In the darkness, in utter isolation, Jesus bore it all. To the point where finally he became a curse. As Galatians 3:13 says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. You may have heard the story about a family that had waited too long to abandon their home as wildfires kind of spread around them. So, you know, imagine blazing fires surrounded this family and blocked their escape. And so this desperate dad had an idea. He burned some trash in the field behind their home. And he put his family in that spot. And they kind of huddled together as the fire rages around them. And they felt a little bit of the searing heat, but they were spared because the fire didn't come to the spot where they were. There was nothing left to burn there. In the same way, the cross is the one safe place for sinners to run. The fire of God's wrath fell there once. It will never fall there again. The cross, friends, is safe ground because it's singed ground. And this brings us to our final point. Point number three. The Father welcomes sinners. I want you to take note, after his death, immediately the camera moves from the cross and it moves to the temple in a sense. In these last kind of few chapters, we've heard a lot about the temple. Jesus observed the temple. He cleanses the temple. Accusations about him destroying the temple. And now the camera kind of zooms in on the temple, starting in verse 38. Let's read this verse together. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This is the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies, where the the Ark of the Covenant, there it is, the Ark of the Covenant sat, and on top of the Ark of the Covenant was the mercy seat, and there's passages in Isaiah that talk about how God is in the heavens and his feet lie on this mercy seat, so it's kind of depicting the presence and the power of God with his people, so it represents God's very presence. No one but the high priest once a year could enter this place behind the curtain. Now, I want you to notice this. This is really cool. Look at the word torn in verse 38. Do you see that? Can you remember the first use of the word torn in Mark's gospel? I'd be really impressed if you remember this. It's in the first chapter of Mark. What happens to the heavens right after Jesus' baptism? As soon as he came up out of the water, he saw the heavens being torn open. And the Spirit descending on him and a voice saying, "You are my beloved Son." It's interesting. Matthew and Luke's gospel say that the heavens opened, but Mark's gospel says that they were torn open. This is an answer to Isaiah's prayer in chapter 64 when Isaiah says, "Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down." You've probably heard people say, "All hell is breaking loose." Have you heard that before? At Jesus' baptism, Mark is saying that all heaven is breaking loose. This is gospel, isn't it? This is good news because God sent Jesus from heaven down to earth that there would be this kind of irreversible tear in the fabric of this world which would result in heaven touching earth. So Mark's gospel begins with the tearing of the heavens. It ends with the tearing of the curtain. First, the heavens are torn and God comes to us. Now the temple curtain is torn so we can go to God. This curtain was a symbol of humanity's separation from God. Sinful humanity could never enter God's presence. But now access to God is open. The barrier is broken. The veil is torn. Notice it says from top to bottom, as if God's very own hands made the tear. According to Hebrews chapter 10, starting in verse 19, listen to this. This is the writer of Hebrews probably reflecting on this very event, perhaps this very verse, certainly this very idea. And notice what he says and how we are to apply this thought or this idea. He says, now we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is through his flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, here it is, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith. That's the application for us today. Christians can confidently, we can boldly draw near to God. Friends, there's not one moment, if you're a Christian, this is true of you, there's not one moment in your present life where you need to fear coming into God's presence. Right now, in this very moment, a week from now, 3 months from now, in your hardest of trials, when you're praising God and rejoicing him, in all of your moments, you can draw near to God because of what Jesus did on the cross. And do you see who the first one is to kind of draw near in our passage? Look at verse 39. When the centurion who was standing opposite him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. You're wondering what kind of the mountaintop of this entire gospel, I think here it is. I think we have it right here with this particular man. You have to remember back in the day, back in, this is probably, I don't know, fall of 22 or something like that, when we started the Gospel of Mark, the opening verse says something like, this is the beginning of the Gospel of Mark. This is the beginning of the Gospel, which is the good news about Jesus, who is the Son of David and the Son of God. And so right away, we're introduced to this idea that this Jesus is the Son of God. And we kind of wonder whether that's actually going to be true as we're walking through the gospel. And all these different people get it wrong. And some of the people get it kind of right, but they're also wrong. But there's just very few that are actually attesting and giving credibility that Jesus is the Son of God. Then you get to this end and you see Jesus on the cross and you see the centurion. It's not just the cross and the curtain. It's this confession that really is remarkable. Because, friends, this isn't Caiaphas. This isn't the high priest. This isn't Peter, the disciple, who's making this confession. This is an unnamed Roman centurion, the least likely person to see the cross as the victory of God. He must have seen thousands of executions, all of them showing the victory of Rome. But this was entirely different, wasn't it? Notice how Mark slows down the story in verse 39. This man, standing nearby, he saw the way Jesus breathed his last. He was watching. He was taking it all in. He was listening to everything that was going on, in particular what Jesus was saying. The mockers were saying, we will proclaim your kingship if you come down from the cross. But this man proclaims Jesus' sonship after he had died on that cross. You see, friends, those who see what the cross is and what it does, they are the ones who will come to embrace who Jesus really is. You cannot know Jesus without his cross. The cross is the defining symbol for God's messianic king. It's interesting, Psalm 22 opens with, why have you abandoned me, God? And then it closes with the nations worshiping God. And isn't that precisely what happens here in our scene, what occurs at the cross? We see Jesus' initial cry, and then it ends with this Gentile making a confession. Jesus was abandoned so this Gentile could be welcomed. This Gentile outsider, this dog, as the Jews would call him, he is confessing rightly what so many insiders, the Jews, the religious elite, even his disciples, failed to see and confess. Even the bystanders around Jesus, they think Jesus is calling out to Elijah. Everybody is missing the point. And alongside the Roman centurion, notice verses 40 and 41. Mark mentions women here as well. You know, these second-class citizens, at least in the first century world. This is not accidental. Before the cross, in the wake of the centurion's rightful confession, these female disciples are commended in a very real way. We are all outsiders, aren't we? We are all second-class citizens with God. But Jesus has made a way through his shed blood for us all to be with God. Do you see, friends, the indiscriminate nature of the gospel? That it's for all nations, that it's for all kinds of people. I kind of wonder, is there a particular person, is there a particular group of people you think is too far gone for Jesus? That one person in your family, you know, that classmate you've penned as hopeless, your spouse who is so set in his ways? Do you believe that the gospel is big enough to save them? Do you believe that the gospel is powerful enough to change them? Can Jesus save a jihadist? Can Jesus save a transgender man? Can Jesus save a hastily divorced woman, a sex offender, a North Korean, a wicked hypocrite, your strange Uncle Tom? Nothing is impossible with God. No one is beyond the reach of the Father's love because the cross makes a way for all to come in. Friends, because of what Jesus did on the cross, there is no one who is too unsavable, no one that is too unlovable. There's no one that's too unapprovable, as my friend Jared likes to say. And that means something for you and me. People in this world may offer you a feeble, unsatisfying morsel of approval, a little scrap that is here 1 minute and it's gone the next. But only God can give you all of his approval all of the time, a feast of approval. Because at the cross, all of your deserved divine disapproval was put on Jesus. So you don't have to live for the approval of others anymore. You already have God's approval. Listen, brothers and sisters, because Jesus was abandoned, you never will be. Because Jesus drank the cup of God's wrath, you will never experience his wrath. Because Jesus heard dead silence from his Father as he cried out, you will hear only affection from your heavenly Father. Because God turned his face from his Son at the cross, he will never turn his face away from you. He will only smile upon you. God has his eyes on you. He set them on you before the foundation of the world. And because of what Jesus did on the cross, his gaze, his love, his affection will never leave you. Amen. Let's take a moment now to ponder the passage.